Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. It's always interesting in beginning a Dhamma talk with this kind of the amount of uncertainty that's there over, you know, where each and every one of you are at, and what will be effective, what will be helpful, you know, what to say, how much to say, what do you know already, and so on. So generally I just kind of sit in that and just bring up a sense of kindness, just a wish to offer something that may be of use to you. And generally in these talks, as you know, you talk for 40 minutes, if you get something that you get 20 seconds of something that really stays with you, that's a pretty good night. Because it's Dhamma is like that, you know. Every little bit is kind of microcosmic fragment of it contains a lot, actually. Mm. And the very sense of uncertainty itself is something that I think we all recognise or come into, and we don't like it very much. So there can be a lot of nervousness reactions around a sense of uncertainty, what we do in social groups to make sure we're not doing anything rude or impolite, what we do, you know, to make sure that wherever we go we won't be harmed, what we do to make sure we've got all the gear we need to mean that we won't kind of find somewhere where we're without our comforts, our food, drink, shelter, sunblock, mobile phone, credit card, wallet, keys, watch, clock, water bottle, you know, so forth. Kind of tokens of control that we carry around with us, and belts of it, little bits of plastic and things that will get us places or make sure we can get in contact with things. You realise how much kind of preparation goes on, you know, that we want us to do unconsciously. Who walks out without a watch and a key and a piece of plastic? Who dares venture forth? So it's kind of interesting, you know, just to notice some of this stuff that we tend to not even really take into account. That without that, what's it like? Without what's it like? And so a lot of the time in Dhamma practice you're starting to actually push back, stretch the envelope, push back some of the away, some of these little things, tokens that we use to calm our nervousness or uncertainty. So I just have to trust. Just have to open my mind and trust, you know, and ground myself, breathing in, breathing out, centering myself, breathing in, breathing out. Centering myself in harmlessness, good intention. Centering myself in Dhamma. And that's the point of it. It's the kind of most compact, portable accessory to always take with you. Wherever you go. Never gets out of date. Translates into any language, any situation. Mm. Just being on the road, and I travel quite a bit, sometimes I pause and just kind of look at the signs around me, you know, what's going on, the amount of buzz and movement there is, and things that, you know, seductions and fears and voices threatening your luggage will be detonated if you move more than 2 yards away from it. And you think, wow, what a, you know, the kind of the ratcheting up of the nervous system that occurs in human spaces. Mm. And then particularly coming through airports, I sometimes have these moments when I, you know, I land in Britain, say, or in America, and I haven't actually passed through customs yet. I'm standing in the baggage hall picking up the baggage. I haven't actually really been allowed into the country. And you look around, you see things like, well, that's, this place is coming from Rome. This is going to Tel Aviv. One's from Toronto. You see, and everybody in airports is going somewhere else. To Toronto, Tel Aviv, Rome, you know, going somewhere else. Where are we? Where are we now? Where am I now? I'm not really in any of these places. I haven't, and yet I'm not even in Britain or America yet. I haven't actually been allowed in. That sense of kind of momentary statelessness. You know, when we have no particular destination, no particular place we've arrived, we're kind of in this limbo state of, well, you know, what happens if they don't let me in? You know, and particularly when you're a monk, you don't have a credit card, you don't have keys, you don't have money, you don't have these things, so what are you going to do? You know, there's that kind of moment the mind has to drop into a deeper place of where I am and what I'm taking refuge in and what I'm grounded in. Not a place, not a destination, not these kind of conditioned phenomena that come and go. But in being present, centering oneself in that. And it's a kind of process of really unpeeling, you're seeing all the layers of things that we've accumulated in nationality, possessions, location, I have a home and a place I belong to, and relationships, and things we've actually, some of them helpful, skillful, good, whatever, all accumulated layers. And sometimes you get into these moments when one of them breaks or disappears. Yeah. You know, somebody passes away. You leave home, you lose something. There's this moment of disorientation, sometimes more than a moment. You know, when the mind really rocks because it hasn't got its normal bearings. Uncertainty. And this is a place of Dhamma practice. It's the place where you can transfer, you can switch over, you can step over from the seemingly solid, tangible, finite, knowable, which breaks up, to the seemingly intangible, unknowable, which doesn't break up. Most of our practice is really just kind of forming these this process of learning, you know, directly connecting to the mind, its behaviors, learning from perhaps the most important thing we need to learn from, just what's making us tick, how do we operate, what drives us, what holds us, what frees us, what lifts us up, what pushes us down. The most important learning. And meditation itself is perhaps the quickest way to learn. You know, sitting still, sitting quietly, breathing in, breathing out, watching what's going on. Because you're most directly connecting getting feedback from how you operate, feedback from how you've operated in the past, feedback from the things we hold on to, feedback from just the feeling of holding on, that kind of slight tenseness or preoccupation or busyness. You're starting to learn about this stuff, you know. And, learning from how, real common experience in meditation is you find yourself completely engrossed in something, some sort of thing that's not really here at all. Engrossed in some thing one said 5 years ago, 2 years ago, yesterday, something that could happen, or might happen, or shouldn't have happened, or you think did happen, or you feel ought to happen, but it isn't happening. Except that feeling of it should and it oughtn't is happening, and you're not going to let go of that one, because it should and it ought to, and it, or it shouldn't, should it? And you kind of, there goes an hour of one's life. Or what if, And you see how many of these kind of preoccupations start to learn how, the very sense of preoccupation is itself profitless. Why do you need to be preoccupied? Why couldn't we just be where we are? Why is it so difficult? Why does the mind kind of trying to keep wanting to move out of that? Plans, strategies, aims, speculations, all kinds of themes and topics. How many meditation periods have I spent telling myself how to meditate? Why does it keep doing that, And we come up against this tremendous fundamental urge for the finite, the knowable, and the concrete, the stable, that which can be said and known, planned, remembered, recollected, strategized, prepared for the future, mulled over, And it's this movement towards the form, the conditioned. So one of the things obviously one learns a lot about just what is skillful and what's unskillful, what kind of things that really, really ugly to be preoccupied with, thoughts of malice, thoughts of craving, thoughts of vindictiveness, pettiness, and how you just started getting a bit bigger and letting go and loosening up some of that stuff. And it's our kind of our most fundamental and humble learning is to recognize, these tendencies towards violence and pettiness and manipulativeness. These kind of, because what you learn, really important thing is to learn, is not to be starting to kind of just moralize and judge them and or deny them, but how to release them. That there is a release which is not effected just through lecturing oneself to be otherwise. It's not released through slapping another set of rules and values on top of it. It's released by a kind of opening and widening of the mind, a sense of relaxing and letting go of that agitation, that tightness, that hardness, that frenzy, that anxiety, that restlessness. Letting go of the form, letting go of the formulated. And this is, first of all, why it's based upon, first of all, just what skillful and unskillful, because very immediately you get the feedback that, hey, this stuff is just making me feel bad. And, I can actually just let go of it. Not dump it, suppress it. I can let go of it and feel good. It's taught me that. It's taught me how attractive, how righteous, how, you know, on top of it all I can feel when I adopt one of these things, and just how stressful and painful that makes my life in the present. And that there can be a letting go of it, rather than I am this, I'm always stuck with this. There can be a letting go of this. And the letting go of that is comfortable, peaceful, suffusive. It doesn't make me into something more strategized. It makes me into something more open and compassionate and peaceful. It doesn't make me into something more righteous and moralizing or blaming or judging. It makes me into something that's actually more spacious and open and compassionate. So we learn this. So to really learn, you learn it through pain. There's this saying of Proust, I think Marcel Proust said, we aspire to the good and the truthful. The pain we obey. When it hurts enough, you drop it. It's a kind of bit grim, but it's a view of human nature. But we say that it does, you know, because the truth is something we can always figure out. We can think truth is an idea. Yeah. So you want to hold to an idea of truth. You want to hold to an idea of the right. Hold to the idea of the pure and the peaceful. But, you know, you cling to it. But the pain of clinging is something that you lets you experience truth as something that's not finite, not formed, not contrived, not owned, not mine. Something where there's just a dissolution of tension and strife. Something that can embrace us in all our struggles. Something that's really accessible as we cultivate just this one particular move. How does one relinquish stress, relinquish this disagreeable? How do we first acknowledge it is disagreeable? We learn that in meditation. Because you're trying to learn beyond the topic of the mind almost what the energies of the mind do. Yeah. And so, you know, why the Buddha really emphasized wholesome and unwholesome. And these are not just value judgments, you know, social value judgments. These are actual descriptions, as accurate as he could, simply as he could say, about particular energies that have very palpable results. The wholesome is all those energies and moods and inclinations, those kind of movements of intention, movements of attitude, movements of our and do it, that tend towards making us feel larger, wholer, more whole, more balanced, more grounded. And you feel good, you feel comfortable. The unwholesome, you feel more edgy, sharp, precarious, stressed, tight. And, you know, the unwholesome may be obvious things like, you know, malice. You know, you can't comfortably just accommodate and relax into malice. I mean, you can hold it, but there's a holding, there's a tension there to hold it. You've got to keep energizing it. You've got to keep putting in that thought of the rotten thing they did and how I'm going to get even with them, whatever it is. It doesn't sustain itself. The unwholesome does not sustain. It requires continual input. It's an effort to keep it going. An effort that one gets kind of trapped into is, admittedly, it's not always a voluntary effort. Sometimes you just kind of, these reflexes occur. But wherever we can, the cultivation is to make what seems first of all just to be a reflex into something that we have some choice over. You know, because with the meditation you're starting to look very closely and you've got a grounded place and you can feel that arising, you've got a choice. Do you want to follow that? Or there's somewhere better to go? And a very simple kind of fundamental technique, if you like, that we begin with in meditation, I'm still working with it, just going into the body, to feel the wholesome and the unwholesome, to really feel it, not just have some another judgment or mental idea of it, but because these things definitely affect your whole nervous system. You've only got one, you haven't got one for your mind and one for your body. The whole thing runs through one channel. And, you know, the validity of meditation based in the body is that it brings the mind and the body together. The mind and the body correlate at the level of feeling. What you feel in your mind, you feel in your body. When you feel fear in your mind, you feel it in your body. When you feel joy in your mind, you feel it in your body. When you feel love in your mind, you feel it in your body. When you feel hate in your mind, you feel it in your body. And because of that correlation around the experience of feeling, which the mind and the body share, and the mind and the body correlate, it's possible to get some leverage on this very powerful experience we have of feeling, which stirs up our emotions, which galvanizes our attention, which thrusts us into action. In the body, you've got a place where you can just say, wait a minute, let's just hold that. And you can sense, through meditation, you begin to sense how this kind of capturing of mental feeling can be released into the body. And when I say the body, I don't mean, you know, into your fingers or your nose, but into the feeling, the felt sense of the body as we sit here, that sense of being embodied, that sense of having a kind of simple location of groundedness. So, fundamentally breathing in and out brings you into the energy system of the body, the feeling system of the body, the nervous system of the body. And this is so you get a direct correlation between mental feeling and perception and physical or bodily, and the body can govern the mind. The body can give the mind some feedback, say, hey, you're making me feel really tense, you're making me feel really unpleasant, you know, drop that, will you? And there's a place you can drop it. You can actually drop it, return to the breathing, return into your body, drop it, relax, and just let your attention widen. So very often the mental feeling, when it, as it moves into action, means you come into something very sharp, you know, kind of pointed. The mind can pinpoint, comes down to one point on a particular thought or an impression, it's kind of running away with that. And you just stop and widen your attention, something like that. Because that is the gesture of relaxation. And what does it take to widen your attention? First of all, the acknowledgement of this is unpleasant, this is stressful, I don't trust this. And so the widening of attention implies no value judgment, no analysis. It's just saying, well, let's, you know, stay with that, but just get wider, feel what it feels like. So you've got some way of sensing your specific thought, attitude or idea in a much more balanced way. Balance needs width. You look at a tightrope walk and they always have a kind of pole they carry, don't they? You know, the wider your span, the more balanced you are. And it's just kind of coming back to that as a reference point. To live with balanced mind, balanced attention. So you learn a lot about, as you learn the unskillful and the skillful intentions, you see that every intention, every kind of imperative, every impulse, every inclination of the mind, yeah, as a kind of as a localizing effect. You are somewhere, you're doing something, you're interested in that particular thought, you're interested in that particular sensation, you want to go to that place, you become quite localized. Suddenly you want to fly to Rome, you know. You've got your ticket, I want to go there. You're not in some kind of indefinite space, I want to be there, I want to go there. I don't want to be here, I want to be there. You know, you become very localized. It's got that kind of quality. That's what intention does. Impulse, inclination. It makes something quite specific. And first of all, you've got to be very clear about which ones you actually want to be specific, what you want to, which plane you want to get on, you know, where you want to go. And then eventually, why do you want to go? Where are you going to? Where's your intention going to? Why do you want to go somewhere? What's the movement? What's the restlessness? What's the push? Could we get more comfortable where we are? So you start to contemplate the very, you know, experience of that directive mind. And now what a reflex that is. There are very fundamental things that I'm sure we're all biologically geared to. One is, I want to be safe. I don't want to be somewhere where I'm going to get shot to pieces. I want to be somewhere safe. I'd like to be somewhere where I, you know, get some feel good happening. Where I get my supplies in, you know, my stash, my warmth, my enjoyment experience going. I want to be somewhere that's happening. I want freedom from fear, freedom from loss. And that's the kind of, seems to me, that's the bottom line of all the movements. And most of that, from that movement is so strong, it's so, you know, biologically geared. I mean, even slugs want that, I'm sure. That you can't really cut it out. But it's a matter of saying, just check in with, is this going there? Does this plane go there? Does this impulse go there? How long for? Yeah. How long's the ride on an ice cream? You're gonna feel good. How long's the place how secure is that place of security? Yeah. You can see this kind of this paradigm being played out in the world. Every country's got its Ministry of Defence. There's not a single country that's dedicated to aggression. What a wonderful, peaceful world we live in. all these states and nations just set up to make us feel really comfortable and secure. We should be really peaceful, shouldn't it? There's not a single ministry of war in the world. Yeah. So how come? How come the more defense we have, the more rattled we get, the more frightened we get, the more fear there is? Yeah. How come? Because as soon as you start looking at things in that light of what one might be, what could happen, the terrors that might happen if we're not careful, then, you know, the whole thing starts to escalate, doesn't it? You get the defense. Well, because it might go wrong, we better blast them first before they get in. And so it goes, you know, on that reflex. So you get kind of situations where the whole thing spins out of control. What about the daring of, what would it be like if I just kind of trusted? You know, what about if I practice loving kindness and generosity instead? What about if I accepted the fact that I'm going to die? and said, okay, you know, I can't do much about that. Really. I might die, you know, every time I get in a car, I definitely think to myself, well, you know, could end up smashed up under a truck. Nothing I can do about it, really. Well, limited. Some virus might have its little beady eye on me at this very moment. Could get into my central nervous system and totally impassively cause me all kinds of extreme degrading pain and death. What can you do, you know? How much can you do? Or you say, well, I can't do all that much about that. What I can do something about is fear. Yeah, I can do something about that. The rest of it, I just have to take my chance. And, because that's it, isn't it? How long do ones want to live running scared? So, you know, we can work with that very welling up of anxiety from the minor social anxieties, the anxieties about, what if I get it wrong? You know? What if it doesn't work? What if I'm left here alone? You know? Anything? Okay. Just look over the edge of that. Look over the edge of what if. And just wait. Let your mind open up. And realize, you know, that we've been running away from phantoms. If you examine, you know, the attitudes we have, like what if I get it wrong? You've been getting it wrong all your life, you know. It's no big deal. Everybody's getting it wrong. Everybody's making mistakes. Everybody's kind of falling, you know, losing it, blundering, not noticing, not being as respectful, polite, kind, not really detecting a really accurate, spot-on thing, going on too long, babbling on too long, not saying enough, not coming up with the right emotional gesture at the right time. Everybody's getting it wrong. Why don't we just practice forgiveness instead and just get out of this trap? You forgive me and I'll forgive you, okay? Deal. And what if it doesn't work? You know? But it never did work, did it? You know? You show me a gadget that works. They all say they'll work. You know? It's kind of always have this running battle with computers. Everything is breaking down. And we can get through that. We can pass it. We can be bigger than that. We can be bigger than getting it right, getting it wrong. We can be bigger than success and failure. We can be bigger than praise and blame. We can be bigger than gaining and losing. What a relief to get out of the game. Well, I accept it. There's going to be some pain and some, you know, and I might even cause pain. But I really don't want to do that. And maybe the best way I can do it is just by being a bit more relaxed, a bit more at ease, a bit more broad-minded, a bit more less concerned about being absolutely perfect and right and on time and prepared and strategized and defended, socially approved, you know, so forth. Just, you know, go down in your belly, relax, breathe out, open up, and trust that as a human being, you've got what it takes to be a human being. And you can learn from that. And you can learn to not make a big deal out of it, and you can learn to not get confused by it. You learn to not expect miracles out of it, and then you can learn to let go of it, come out of it, come out of the agitation and the self-consciousness that rises up in these forms. This is really important to learn, isn't it? This is nothing that's so esoteric, nothing so kind of, you know, even high-minded. It's just basic sanity. But the wonderful thing is, this is also, it's very ordinary. It's also extremely profound because it actually starts to dismantle all of those kind of reflexes that seem so ingrained and so out of control, and they grip me and they push me around and they make me flustered and they make me say things I wish I hadn't said and they make me snappy and they make me sad. They start to dismantle all that stuff and dismantle, you know, my hold on being something and proving something and getting somewhere and all that need, till one can be marvellously right here in a place that doesn't have a location. Because it doesn't have a location, you never leave it. Because you never leave it, you can't leave it. There's not that kind of grief and sadness and ups and downs and holding on and worry about it. This is what the mind is held by intention, by the kind of drive, whether that's a subtle inclination or it's a nagging thrust or it's a reflex twitch or it's a determined thrust, you know, or however it is, and it's held by that, and it's held by attention, by landing somewhere, by occupying something, by setting up boundaries, you know, this particular object I attend to, this particular scenario I'm with, this particular physical form I'm bound in, I'm with that, this is my area, this is my concern, this is my place. Those are the boundaries of attention. And the mind is held between attention, what it spans itself over, what it nestles on, what it rests upon, what it occupies, and by intention, where it wants to go and what it wants to do in that territory, what territory it wants to create. And you see this continual play between these. And through learning, through the very ongoing learning, as you begin to come through the topics of the mind, through the thing that occupy you, just through the very mainsprings of the intention, that wish to be, to have, to make, to do, to go, to become, to avoid, to sort out, which is kind of, you know, it's an agitated push and attention, which means I'm holding a particular ground, I'm holding a particular piece of space, you know, my mind, my body, my territory, wherever it is. Have you sensed that? These are both stress. And as you begin to kind of calm your attention, calm your intention, steady your intention, and make your attention something that's very permeable, it can spread. You can go past your boundaries of uncertainty, of fear, of holding. You can go past your limitations. Your mind can open beyond that. You see where intention and attention dissolve and the mind is released. But in the ongoing truthfulness of our practice, it's really important to sift through all that kind of static and white noise that the emotions and the psychologies are setting up, to really see, to really get a handle on what intention feels like, you know, in your nervous system, what attention, how that limits you, how that feels, how big you feel right now. how much space you have, you know, how bound you feel when you're really occupied with a whole series of thoughts, how tight and narrow you feel, how, you know, how your attention bunches up. And you start to sense this is, you know, in the bodily sense, you get a kind of real feeling for this and the release of that. This is what we practice. This is what we practice. This is the dissolving. Dissolving, and it involves the dissolving of one's controls, one's self-image, one's self-territories. So for that, it's got to be a comfortable ride. You know, and we can feel in breathing in and breathing out, in the sense of good friendship, in the sense of morality, moral living, you feel the fundamental sense of it's okay. It's okay to be here. You know, it's okay. That gives you that, just that edge, that ability to trust the process of practice. So there are intentions that are skillful. Intentions that lead to the disbanding of intention. There are things to attend to carefully. And perhaps the most important thing to attend to carefully is the quality of intention itself. Where you're going, why you're going, how you're operating, whether you're desperate, speedy, dithering, joyful, you know. Whether it's a skillful, unwholesome, you know, just to really get a touch and sense of that. What is the intention that leads to the disbanding of that? And is the dissolving of that into, in your own body, or your own apparent, your own here and now experience? So offer this for your reflection.
Om Dhamaya Dhamapitaya Sadhukaram Dadamase
Sadhukaram.